Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2018. Lecture 11, delivered on February 21, 2018. The title of this lecture is Credit Risk.
Today, credit risk. As I had said before, since this is the last evening of business week, I will be letting the class out at 5:50, a little early. I'm sorry, not 5:55, but a little early so you can get prepared to go to the Business Week function tonight, which is the culmination. The Business Week seems to be coming even more important. I went to the career fair last night, and I'm already seeing salaries starting to slide. It was a little bit appalling to me. I almost had a few words with a few of the employers who were looking for top-notch students, and they were offering in the upper 30s and lower 40s again. I wanted to ask them, do you have any grasp of what kind of student loan payments these people are going to have when they finish here? But they're bargain hunting now, and so things are looking a little bit darker. But again, today, credit risk. Let me show you the numbers, and we're just going to keep doing this, and you'll begin to get the idea that this is something that's important for professionals to do. First, really? Oh, goody, we're going to just have a bunch of ads. Just like always and forever. Madam, good day or bad day? Don't ask a question. Good day or bad day? Bad. Okay. Let me turn down the light so you can see this a little better. It wasn't a spectacularly bad day in the grand scheme of things, but it was a negative day across the board, which of course indicates that nothing outstandingly unusual about it, but having a look at the Standard & Poor's 500 as just that one of those benchmarks. Oh, look at that. This was a day where there wasn't a whole lot of excitement. At the beginning there was, at the bell, do you see the rally at the bell, at the opening bell? It was not a spectacular rally, and then it just kind of floated upward through the day, and then about 2 p.m., you had, ma'am, describe it for me, at about 2 p.m. Yes, you had a rally, the bulls stepped up to the plate and worked the market, but there was, just see that spike of volume, see that little bar down there at the bottom, that little spike of volume, that looks like that was just a little bit of, that might have even been just a concentrated institutional buy. You see that little spike right there of volume? And then there was some excitement, the bulls moo, moo, we all get to moo. And then the alien mothership comes in and abducts the cows, the bulls, and from there, it was pretty much a slide. Bulls tried to rally, but by the end, it was a steep decline. And again, there's that ending. It seems to be a persistent feature now that at the end, the bulls just say, the heck with it, we're going home. They go home and they have steaks. It sounds kind of, you know, cannibalistic, but hey, they're steaks. Again, you're seeing a repeating pattern. Now, you got to watch it with patterns, because as soon as the pattern sets up, then there's going to be some traders, smart traders, are going to take advantage of it and sucker people into the pattern and then pull back on them real fast. But it does look like there was a pretty serious notch there at the end. And this is going to be happening over and over again. This is going to be one of those where there's not going to be a lot of dramatic movement for a while, probably. But, you know, and you had the volume, on balance volume. There's nothing really spectacular. But again, look at this at the end. See that volume every day? It seems like at the end of the day, there is just this sell-off. And, there you go. I'm going to show you something here before we go much further. I want to see what our short interest is standing at. I'm not going to be able to see a good short interest. I want to show you a good short interest number, and then I'm going to teach you something I'll bet you don't know. See if I can get a good number on it. I thought there was one on. Whoops. Where's our short interest? Well, maybe I can find it here. It's hard to find an actual number for the total short interest. Now, let me explain short interest to you. Most people think that buying and selling stocks is how markets work. You buy stocks and you sell stocks. There is a whole other side to the market. It's a little more complex conceptually, but it is a huge part of the market. And it is one of those things that you need to keep an eye on. Now, honestly, you used to be able to find a lot of numbers, the total short interest. More likely these days you're going to find short interest by stock. But there are aggregate numbers. Short interest works like this. And I'll give you an example. Suppose that a stock stands at, let's say, XYZ common stock, stands right now at $100 per share. You, ma'am, are a cynic. You have no use for anything. Grumpy Cat is your guardian angel. And so when you see something like this, you say, I don't think it's going to stay there at $100. Okay, well, you're not going to buy it, obviously, and you don't own it, so you can't sell it. But is there a way you can make money off it if you think the price is going to fall? The answer is absolutely yes. Now, this is where it gets a little weird. You can actually go in, call your broker, and say, hi, I should like to borrow XYZ stock. I want to borrow XYZ stock. Okay. So what will happen then is that you will then have in your portfolio XYZ. It's not yours, you just borrowed it. What you'll do is then you will sell that XYZ stock at $100 a share. Now, if your bet is right, the stock price is going to fall. So let's say that the stock price falls XYZ in, let's say, 5 days, it falls to $95. At that point, what you do is you buy XYZ at 95. Okay, now you sold it at 100. So you've got $100 in your portfolio. Now, here, you've bought it back, so you have to pay $95 to buy it. Now, you own it now, so you can give it back to the where you borrowed it from. Here it is. Here it's back. And so what you do is you pocket $5 for every share that you short sold. That's short selling, in a nutshell. Now, you won't probably pull $5. You'll have to pay some interest on the borrowing and a commission maybe. But this is short selling. And so, short selling is the other side of the market that you never hear about. And we use the term short interest. All that means is how much short activity there is in a stock. The short interest. So now let's look at, for example, remember the spider I told you about, the index, the ETF of the S&P 500? Let's have a look. Let's see what's going on with it. The short interest has increased by 10.9 million shares. As short interest expands, that is a clear indication that that security, that stock, has a lot of people who think it's going to go down. A lot of investors think it's going to go down because they are borrowing shares of the stock, and then they are simply waiting and selling them right away. Then waiting for the price to fall so they can buy them back and give them back to where they borrowed them from. See what I mean? It's not. This is why we don't talk about short interest so much in the common news media, because it's just a little bit head spinning how it works. And the typical person who watches those kinds of foolish programs, they're not really equipped for this conceptual framework. But this is how you tell market sentiment. Even more so than when you're looking at, oh, the price went up and down. Look at how the short interest is playing, especially on an index. This is saying that there is a market sentiment. A lot of investors believe that the S&P 500 is going to drop in a short period of time. And so you see the short interest expanding. It's going up. Now, percent of float, the S&P won't have that. You have to watch it because the percent of the float is how many shares of this stock are outstanding in the universe. If we say percent of float, we're saying how much of that total stock outstanding is now in a short interest arrangement. So, for example, if I were to look at Chesapeake Energy, it had an increased, this might be today, I think it's yesterday. The short interest increased by 1.2%, 1.2 million shares. So that was about 0.8% of the total outstanding increase in short. For a total amount of this company's stock in a short position, almost 17% of the stock now is sitting in bets that it's going to go down. That's how you can think of this. How much of the total stock of this company is sitting in bets that it's going to go down? And that's a pretty heavy number. Notice that these numbers go, this one, Snap. Look at Snap. It's got, this is something that's happened just today. Do you see how that went up by 25%, and now the total float is 27.7%. In other words, just overnight, all hell broke loose with Snap. Okay? I mean, that is more than a fourth of the stock is now being bet. Go ahead, talk.
It's for Friday night.
It is? Yeah, I can't read worth crap right now. My eyes are shot today. Jack did me wrong. No, Shut up. Okay. So now, interestingly, the other side of that is that you can see where the market is backing away from negative sentiment. Look at JCPenney, for example. I mean, that's still a nosebleed short position. And if you see the short position too high, that can be a problem for short sellers. Because if so much of it is in short position, you're going to have a hard time buying that stock back to give it back to them up there because it's locked in shorts. And so everyone trying to get stock at the same time is going to drive the price through the roof. And so you're all going to cream each other on trying to close your short positions. So right now, JCPenney is actually coming back. But at the same time, the short position is so terrible on it. I mean, you're just going to have to just sit there and wait. There's no reason to bet one way or the other. Although, this would give me some indication that maybe as a short term, JCPenney is a buy. Because it's clearly the market is turning back favorable to it. Clearly, the shorts are going to have a hard time trying to close their positions. And as they try to close them by buying back the stock to give it back to where they borrowed it from, they're going to be causing the price to go up. So in a case like this, we say the market is running the shorts out. The market is running the shorts out. Now, I'll do this a couple of times just to get you used to it. But don't think, well, I buy and sell stocks, so I am an investment guru. No, if you don't know how to do short sells, and once in a while, you should do a short sell. You got to be careful because there used to be a trick. We would call it bear raids. And we would play short people who had insufficient experience with short positions. What we would do is we would put out negative information, and fools would come in, short the stock until they had these massive positions. And then what we would do is we would just simply go in there and start buying the stock. They'd panic. They'd start trying to sell, close their positions by buying stock. And every one of them would just be pushing the price up as we were just already had bought in. And we'd just sit there, bring it up, bring it up. And they would, at the end of the day, they would all go home, and we'd go home with an extra martini in our lunches. So there you go. You got to watch out. Bear raids are, by the way, illegal now. But what's illegal and what's done are very different things. Lord knows I've lived my life by that rule. Anyway, but do you see the green here is bad news for the market? You understand that when you're looking at short positions, green is bad because that's increasing short positions. As a lot of you... Many of you will never be in a finance class again, and you are thanking the Lord for that. But some of you will be in finance classes, and it blows me away. I'll do these upper-level finance classes. I'll say, okay, we're going to do a short position. And they'll look at me, what's a short? They don't know. And so I start it early, and I just keep harping. This is another part of the market. Maybe half the market sometime. Well, we hope it's not half. But you can see that there is a significant amount. I mean, look at these millions of shares on these just this companies right here. And if you look along here, the ones that you stay away from are the ones that there's already a lot in the short interest, percent of float. That worries, that's always a worry to me. Because that means that if I take a short position, then I'm going to be with these other fools trying to close out our short positions, and we'll all be driving the price up against each other, so we'll ruin the profit that we could make from the price fall. But as long as you're, but it also, it gives you an indication of market sentiment about different stocks. So keep this in mind, that they're buying stocks, selling stocks, and then there is short selling stocks. It's a whole other side of the market that no one seems to know much about. Anyway, I shouldn't say this because, I mean, like I said, even in my advanced finance classes I teach, most of the people don't know anything about shorts. The dangerous part is just starting to show and teach people who might go out there and think that they can do it before they're seasoned enough to know what to look for. Like I said, if everyone's already shorting, That's not a signal for you to short. It's just like if everyone has bought a stock, that is not an indication that you should buy the stock. Simply because if everyone's already bought the stock, then they've topped the stock out. And from there, it's probably going to be going down. The same is true of stock offerings. Companies offer stock in stock offerings, sell stock to the public, when the stock is at its high price, according to their projections. Because that's when they'll get the most per share in the offering. They don't sell their, they don't do public offerings when they think their stock is at its bottom. They do their stock offerings when they're projecting that the stock is near its top. So you got to watch it. Don't think that just because you see everyone else doing it, that's a great idea to do it. I'm trying to see here if there's anything else that's kind of significant. Well, McDermott, yeah, that doesn't look, that looks a little grim. Noble Corp. Notice that I'm looking at a, like about 15 to 20%. When I get to that level, that's a clear indication that the stock is going to fall in price. But at the same time, that's probably, you're too late to take a short position. It's going to do you any good. And then Financial Select. One thing also, just to as a warning to you, or not a warning, an advisory to you. Look at sector. Look at things. If you see short positions, these are the biggies in the short positions. If short positions are increasing abnormally in a sector versus overall, that can give you some very important information that might even be worth you in considering in your investments. If you're talking about, if you're writing a term paper, well, the short interest on the companies in the financial sector has been increasing over the past several months, which is an indication that market sentiment is turning against these companies, the banking industry. But I want to show you here. Wait. Look at Rite Aid. Rite Aid made some announcements in the last few days, and notice how the shorts are backing off. Rite Aid is still has a pretty substantial short interest as a percent of float, but at the same time, Rite Aid clearly, whatever it's been talking about as far as its future goes, has scared the shorts away to some extent. More likely what happens is as short positions close, it's a flow. There's short positions that are closing at every given at any given time. That's, and then there's short positions opening at any given time. What you're seeing here is actually the net effect of the closes and the opens. So in Rite Aid's case, what you're most likely seeing is short positions closing, a lot of short positions closing, but there are not as nearly as many short positions opening. So that's what these numbers really mean. It's not just all these people came in at once. No, there is the closing and then there's the opening, okay? And I'll teach you later about what it means days to cover. Days to cover is kind of an important number, too. let me explain real quick. The days to cover is how, this is really bad, but it's how long it would take the whole short position outstanding to be closed out. The shorter that duration, the more impact you'll get on that. If it takes you just a day or two to close out all the positions, that means everyone in the short position is going to buy back in, and there's not going to be a lot of activity. There's not going to be a lot of pressure back up on the stock. The longer the time to close all of the positions, the more pressure there will be of those closings to drive the price back up. So if you've got a close, it takes 10 days for JCPenney to close, oh, that's a bad sign. Because if you're in a short position, it could take you 10 days with everyone else to try to get all of the short positions closed. 10 days, that's just going to boom, boom, boom. The price of JCPenney is just going to go through the roof. That's why I earnestly think that this is definitely at least a short-term buy signal on JCPenney. And it's most decidedly not a time to jump in. Oh, I'm going to get a short position. It'll take me 10 days to get out of it. By then, this price will probably be $1 million. Yeah, so that the here's one at 11. I'm looking to see if there's 11s, 10s, oh, 12. Oh, that's bad. That look, there are still shorts going into that. Even though the days to cover is 12, that, oh well, whatever. 19 days, really? Yeah, over a fifth of the stock is locked in short position. It would take 19 days to close it out. Oh, that hurts. And they're still taking short positions even at that. That's a stock that is in real trouble. Let me see something. Is that OHI? Let me do something real quick. OHI, just humor me for a minute here. Let's see what's happening with the stock. OHI. Yeah. Yeah. Projection on the price, 25.71. Well, this projection says it's actually going to go up. It's paying a dividend, too. Here's that. You're paying a dividend, even though you're in a bad position as far as your... And their earnings per share, but look at that price-to-earnings ratio. At 50, yeah. What's the beta of that stock? Where's the beta? That's a low-risk stock, too. Okay, that's the kind that's too confusing for me. I'm a simple person. I don't believe in complicating my life like that. Okay, now. Okay, let's look at the yield curve. And I'm going to come back to this because there's something else that I have to show you today. It has to do with credit risk or default risk. Okay, here we are by the numbers. Now, there's an interesting thing. Notice that all interest rates, we're looking at the 7 to 10-year notch. The 7-year went up 5 basis points. The 10-year went up... Ooh, no, 6 basis points. So the yield curve arced a little bit more. It's not as flat as it was. See how yesterday it was at 5 basis points spreading. Today it's at 8 basis points. It's like I said, it's just going to kick up and down, float. So far the 10-year is staying above the 7-year. And the 7-year is definitely staying above the 5-year. So we're not in a... I'm just curious here. Yeah, and the 10-year is staying well below the 20-year. So we don't have an inversion. In fact, we backed off a basis point. Yesterday, we were within... We were 7 basis points away from inversion. Today, we're 8 basis points away from inversion. Okay? So that's that. Now, turn this off, turn the lights back on here for a minute, show you something else now. It has to do with yields, treasury yields, but it also has to do with the indications of market activity and market sentiment. This is called credit risk or default risk. And I'm going to go back and again repeat something that I showed you earlier. I've shown it to you twice now, and this will be the third time. And each time I show it to you, I take you a little bit deeper into what it's about. This has to do with the risk structure of an interest rate. Okay? Now remember, an interest rate is a composite of the risk-free rate plus this thing called the default premium. The risk premium. Now, the risk premium has 3 parts to it. There is the default premium, the maturity premium and the liquidity premium or illiquidity premium. Those are the three parts of the risk premium. The default premium, the maturity premium, and the liquidity premium. Or I think the book calls it the illiquidity premium. And every interest rate has its own combination of these three factors. Every interest rate will have its own combination of these three factors. Let's see here. Okay. Now, the one important point here is that if it's a treasury instrument, the only one that it could have is the maturity premium, which will be larger the longer the maturity. And as you can see here, see how the length as you go farther out on the maturity of a treasury instrument, the interest rate, the yield on it goes up. That's purely maturity premium. It is not the default premium because treasuries will not default. And it's not the illiquidity premium because you can sell a treasury at the blink of an eye. The only thing pushing an interest rate up, a yield on a treasury, is the maturity premium. Now, so in other words, I can use this to tease out something that's kind of important. Corporate bonds, they can default. We have a measure that we use. Well, there are actually three different measures. Three different rating systems are out there. S&P, Standard & Poor's, has a rating system. It's AAAs, AAs, and then there's Moody's that has a rating system. It's almost the same, but there are slight differences, little versus big capital A's and B's. And then the other one is Fitch. Fitch has a rating system, too. They all look kind of alike. Go ahead. Okay, it's Moody's. Oh, well, let me write it up here on the board for you. The three rating systems are Standard... Really? Standard & Poor's. Moody's. And Fitch. Now, these rating systems look very similar. Every investment entity has its favored one. Standard & Poor's, and before I go any further, let me make sure you understand, and I'll go back to this subject later in this lecture. Standard & Poor's was, before the 2008 crisis, it was giving very high ratings to securities that were absolute trash. These investment bankers were putting together these very complex derivatives that were just filled with risk, and then wrapping them in a nice, pretty package. And Standard & Poor's was giving them AAA ratings. And they did not, and investors relying on Standard & Poor's just, okay, this is a safe corporate investment and it's some kind of corporate thing. Bought into them and then the crash and that shell just like that and this toxic waste just poured out and just ruined investors who thought they were buying high quality instruments. And they were not. They were buying crap. And Standard & Poor's knew damn well what they were doing. Well, by 2009, 2010, it was clear what Standard & Poor's had been doing. it basically wanted to keep its big bucks coming in from all of these investment banks that were that had been put together these toxic things. And so the feds just crack down on Standard & Poor's. They should have sent people to prison, but they don't. They just fine them. But it still was pretty a big smack to Standard & Poor's. So what did Standard & Poor's do? Instead of meaningfully changing its corporate culture to stop lying, to instead of meaningfully changing its analytic procedures and its checks and balances and its layers of did you do this right? Oh, okay, did you do this right? Instead, what did Standard & Poor's do? It lowered the rating on government treasury bills. That's what it did. Oh, you spanked us? Well, we're going to come back and spank you. Instead of saying I was a bad corporate citizen. Standard & Poor's did that. And since then, and I mean, there are, oh, yeah, I'll go to Standard & Poor's. I don't. And if any of you decide to become investment bankers and I find that you're doing Standard & Poor's, I will come and I will hurt you. I'll hurt your feelings really bad. I'll talk about things like what you eat for dinner. I mean, this isn't some liberal or anything like that. This is responsible corporate policy. And a lot of investors who believed that they were doing right by buying Standard & Poor's ratings that were AAA, they got ruined. And in some cases, banks, whole banks, just boom, because they had put together a lot of their investments. They had the free cash. They put it into Standard & Poor's AAA-rated corporate securities. And then they, well, all of a sudden, those banks, which originally had $100 million in AAA Standard & Poor's rated securities, they had zero. And their essentially the bank just like that, folded. Anyway, Moody's is another one. Tell you a story about Moody's. This is a personal story. Back when I was a consultant, I helped companies go public. Or if a company had gone public and it had been sloppy and didn't understand how much work there was, I would come in and I would get them back into compliance with filings and all that kind of stuff. Back in the day when consultants like me could do that. Now it's illegal for us to do that. But I had my first experience with a reasonably decent corporation. They wanted to issue some debt. They had stock outstanding. We'd stabilized their filings and we'd gotten some good press on them. And so we wanted to do corporate debt, issue paper, so we needed a credit rating. Okay, I had not done it before. Honestly, I just called Moody's, okay? And I explained, here's what I need to have done, acting like I knew what I was doing, which I didn't, and they probably could tell that, but okay, I need a credit rating for a corporate bond. The issue is going to be $14 million, and this will be a single issue of 20-year, and we're still negotiating the price with the investment, the coupon rate with the investment bank. Moody's said, okay, we'll get you the applications, we'll get everything fixed up, you get us your filings and other documents, and we'll get to work on this. And I thought, well, this is not bad. I found out that they had several levels of service. There was a cheap level, you found out what was going to happen after what they rated you at after they rated you. Or you could buy premium services, which they described as giving more attention to your financials, more attention to the prospects of growth of the company, all that kind of stuff, all the analytics. And then I had a very old consultant explain to me, you see, if you buy the premium services, you're going to get a higher credit rating than if you buy the low service. You go cheap, you're probably going to get a C. That's a junk bond rating. You go with a premium service, you might get a B or a B minus. And that's a difference of a lot in the coupon rate that you can offer. With a C, 14%, 15%. With a B minus, 12%. If I could get a B maybe a 10.5% coupon. They were charging for better credit ratings. And this was back in the 1990s, long before. I mean, what are you supposed to do? I went to the, and I told them how much it would cost for a decent non-junk rating. And, oh, the board of directors just hit the roof. That's more than we're wrong. Anyway, I can't tell you much about Fitch. I don't know much about it. Just don't know. I'm going to be honest. Like I said, I don't lie to you. I don't know anything about Fitch, so really that much. Seems like a good rating service. I use it myself, actually, because of the bad taste in my mouth from these two guys. I use Fitch, and I should be more responsible and find out what their dark secrets are, too. Anyway. Okay. Another interesting side aspect of this. Some of you will become responsible for investment portfolios, and almost all corporate entities, when they have money for long-term investments, they have rules and standards. You must invest in certain quality of securities. You can't invest in crap. You are putting others at risk, and you have a fiduciary duty not to do that. So they will say, you must, and here's the example that I'm going to give you, of a company that's actually here in town. It's a quiet company. You might not have even heard of it, but it's an 800-pound gorilla of a company. And one of the treasury officials just simply described what was going on. She said, we had our investment portfolio. It's very large. I mean, it's a lot of money that's accumulated over the years for the investors in this specialized kind of company. And these are not rich. These are mom and pops, but there are just large amounts of money that they is theirs that we shepherd. As we grow, we make profit. It goes into this, and then we can disperse money from it for them and all this, and we can handle the good times and the bad times better for their industry. Well, they had farmed this out some years ago to a specialist company that manages these big portfolios. And they send a report every year or so. Well, this is what we're investing in, your money. And, of course, this company has these standards. This has to be safe stuff. You can't invest in risky stuff. That's forbidden by the charter. Well, interestingly enough, when she got a hold of this, when she took over that duty, she noticed that it was a substantial part of the portfolio, maybe 15%, was in a corporate bond fund that had, at one time, had a AAA rating. It now had a BB rating, way below the charter. She had a fit. She noticed that it had been that way for several years. They had been in violation. It wasn't the investment company. Hey, we were just doing this. It was their responsibility in the company to make sure that everything was right. This investment company dropped the ball and just had a cow. Are you out of your mind? This rating of this part of the portfolio, it's fallen. Well, we just weren't looking at it. No, you got to look at it all the time. If you are responsible for maintaining the quality of the overall portfolio, you've got to keep an eye on it because corporate bonds don't stay at the same rating. If the company is going to hell, there was a time when Sears and JCPenney bonds had very nice ratings. Now they don't. So you have to keep an eye on the quality of the investments. That's the same true when you're investing in mutual funds. Yeah, they're going to watch their investments and make sure that they have a certain quality. That doesn't take the responsibility off you to keep an eye on what they're investing in. And there have been some pretty surprising examples of mutual funds that have had, well, we invest only in A and above, AAA and AAA. And you'll notice, wait a minute, I'm looking at this and it says that's a double A, but if I look at the market on that bond in their portfolio, it says B. Well, how's that work? Oh, well, we just haven't revised it yet. Well, you revise it now, Sparky, for God's sake. You've got something in that portfolio that's not in what I wanted to invest in. Last thing, junk. We don't call it junk bonds. That's inappropriate. We just don't say junk bonds. So what we say is, and I want you to repeat this, sir, non-investment grade.
Non-investment grade?
Yes. In other words, it is a mangy cur, and it foams in the mouth. You can't say that because it'll hurt that poor doggy's feelings. So you say that is a non-house doggy. Okay? We don't say junk, but that's what it is. It's junk bonds or anything that is below the B's. And there are C's, and then there are D's. I can't say that I have ever seen an F, but they might. Well, yes, I have. I've seen Z's, things that should have been Z's. But it just has to do. Now, understand that if you want to invest in junk, there's a higher expected return because there's a higher risk involved. And so if you want to roll the dice on something that is a risky son of a dog, you can go with the junk, the non-investment grade stuff. But if you're a responsible person, or if you are responsible for the quality of the investment portfolio for a company or something like that, then you invest only in investment grade bonds. Now, AAA are the best. It can be capital A's in one of those rating systems, little A's, but this is the best of the best. And down from here, they suck more and more. Although, look, a triple B, a single A, triple B, or a double B, I mean, they are going to give you a higher coupon. They're a higher risk. But are they really at risk of defaulting? Not that much. But that's where what's going on. As the investment grade goes down, until you get to some seriously nasty stuff, until you get to the junk, as the investment grade goes down, all other things being held constant, the default premium will go up on the instrument. Okay? Here's what we do. Here's one of the tricks we use for teasing out one of the pieces of this. And I hope I can show you one of these very quickly. Okay, look. Let's say the return on a 20-year treasury, that would have the risk-free rate in it. And then let me write these pieces out. The default premium on a T20 plus the maturity premium on a T20 and the liquidity premium on a T20. Now, the risk premium is going to be the same for everything. Okay. Now, let's talk about the return, the expected return on a AAA investment grade corporate bond. It would have the risk-free rate in it, as all do. It would have the default premium for a AAA, 20-year, let me put it 20-year, plus the maturity premium for a AAA 20-year, plus the liquidity premium. And I am actually kind of making this more complicated than it really is. Now, the thing of it is that if it's a 20-year treasury, it's not going to have any liquidity premium whatsoever. You can sell it in a minute. A 20-year AAA is not going to have any liquidity premium in it. You can sell it in a minute. As far as the maturity premium goes, if it's both are 20 years, then they will be the same value because it's 20 years of volatility and interest rates. They're exposed to the same interest rate volatility over 20 years. So these two actually will be identical. The only difference, and of course these two are the same, the risk-free rates. So the only difference we would have is the default premium on a 20-year AAA corporate minus the difference, minus the default premium on a treasury of 20 years. But a treasury can't default. So if I take the yield on a 20-year AAA minus the yield on a 20-year treasury, what I will get out of that is nothing but the default premium on a high credit corporate bond. That's what I'll get. And like I said, I'm making this actually more complicated than it is. Watch this. Let me pull up something here. And I do wish I had my nice bookmarks, but now I'm going to try to find the in the risk. Come on. I'm looking for the FRED database here. Dang. Okay. I had it, but I bookmarked it. Okay. Well, let me do it this way. Is that going to get me what I want? I'm looking for FRED, and I can't find FRED in this. I want, if I could just, maybe I could save my bookmarks. Okay. Corporate bond, there we go. Maybe I can do it that way. Not going to find it. It drives me crazy. AAA corporate bond yield. There, Moody's. Yeah. Okay. Let's do dailies. There it is. Okay. This is a composite. Now, in other words, sort of like you add up the yields, they're going to be very close on AAAs, and then you find the average of them. So if you look on, at the end of January 2018, a AAA corporate bond would be yielding 3.55%. Now we can go over to the other table and look at the treasury, and these are 30 years, aren't they? Yeah, those are 30 years. Now look over here at the 30. At the end of January, 2018, let me do that. Okay, at the end of January, the treasury on 131 at 30 years was 2.98%. So in other words, the AAA minus the T, and these are 30-year, would have come out to be 0.55 and 2. It would have been 57 basis points of spread. 57 basis points of spread. In other words, the market at the end of January said, in order to attract investors to the best quality of corporate debt instead of the exact same maturity of government debt will require an extra 0.57 of a percent. That essentially is a measure of the probability of default of high quality corporate debt at the end of January. Again, that was a measure, in a complicated way, that's a measure of the probability of default of corporate debt of high quality. Now, what you would want to do is track that. At the end of February, in a few days, we can do it again with this FRED database. Look at the corporate over here. What its yield is. I wish they granularize this a little bit more. I wish they'd bring this down to the daily. And FRED doesn't do that. But at the same time, you can look at the credit default risk. By the way, that is called default risk or credit risk. You will sometimes hear it called the credit default risk. It is that number. And it is the measure of the probability of default on long-term, high-quality corporate debt. It is a measure of the probability of default on long-term, high-quality, long-term corporate debt. On long-term, high-quality corporate debt. Now, as we teeter toward a recession, what you can do is keep track of that credit default risk. As it increases, well, what you're looking at is an increase in the probability of credit default, of default. Now, the other thing you can do with this is actually, once you've got the AAA, which at the end of January was what? 3.55%, you can do triple B against triple A and see the extra risk of that investment of default. You can go to C's and D's, and you can actually then stack them up and say how much more risk is there at the given time. What should happen is as we approach the recession, the triple A should pull a little bit, that number should get larger. The credit default risk on high-quality corporate debt. That should get larger. Then also the spread between AAA and AA, the spread between AAA and single A, the spread between AAA and triple B. They should all expand. All those numbers should get better. The trick is to look at how much the spread. In other words, if the spread between AAA and AA just expands, and the spread between AA and single A expands by about the same amount, that's not a bad sign. But the more the lower quality debts spread away from higher quality, that says the steeper the recession is and the more likely weak companies are going to default. That's what you look at. And I'll do some more of that later. But that was the most important part of that. It's just for you to know that if I take a high quality, like an index of bonds, like this one, and I say, okay, right now we've got 3.55% against Treasuries at 2.98%. Okay, that's nice. That's a 0.57. But the question is, what does that mean in context? You want to say, okay, what is it at the end of February? What is it at the end of March? And you look to see if that credit default risk is increasing. In other words, if the spread is growing. That's one of those things that is another indicator that we are getting closer to a recession. But for right now, as you go into the last class of the week, you can rest assured that at least for the time being, the yield curve has not flattened anymore, and in fact, you are one basis point further away from the signal of a recession than you were when we met on Monday. Now, what's going to happen for the rest of the week? Well, that's another matter entirely. That's all I have for you. I thank you.